and more about Judge Baldus's legal career, post-World War II legal career, and note here that we're going to see some of the influence of the reconstitution of the Third Reich's judiciary on the law of the Federal Republic. This is going to be amplified considerably in the next section that we look at after this one. Before this, however, Baldus had managed to leave his mark on legal developments in the Federal Republic. As presiding judge of the disciplinary court at the Federal Supreme Court, the panel for disciplinary proceedings against judges and prosecutors, he had served as the country's highest-ranking guardian of professional standards. And as presiding judge in the trial of members of the, quote, Society for German-Soviet Friendship, unquote, he had put himself in the forefront of the prosecution of communists. On July 28, 1955, Baldus's panel charged officers of this organization with, quote, participation in an association guilty of treason toward the Constitution, unquote, with, again quoting, membership in a secret society, unquote, and with, again quoting, participation in a criminal association, unquote. The panel found the crime aggravated by the fact that the society, which had not been made illegal in most Länder, had, quote, held a meeting of the steering committee while the trial was taking place in Karlsruhe and issued public statements, unquote. Another decision handed down by Judge Baldus has had an effect on other cases up to the present. It involves the peculiar definition of, quote, force, unquote, in connection with charges of unlawful duress developed by the second criminal panel under Baldus's leadership in the notorious Lepley decision of August 1969. That's spelled L-A-E-P-P-L-E. Now, what we're going to see here is a legal precedent for, or basically an application of law, which is representative of a key reinstitution of the Third Reich criminal statute, namely defining legitimate nonviolent protest as the use of force against the state and making it officially treasonous. And again, we're going to see a projection of this, an amplification of this, in the next passage that we deal with after this one, of Baldus and the Lepley decision. Inga Müller writes as follows, Klaus Lepley, then president of the Association of Students at the University of Cologne and a member of the Christian Democratic Student Circle, has led a protest with other students against fare increases in the city's public transportation system. They had staged a sit-in on the streetcar tracks and had succeeded in blocking several trains. In a first trial, they were acquitted by the County Court of Cologne. However, the second criminal panel set aside the verdict, warning the lower court that, quote, recognizing a right to demonstrate to the extent accepted by the criminal chamber of the county court would be equivalent to legalizing terror committed by militant minorities, unquote. Continuing, repeating that last sentence. In a first trial, they were acquitted by the county court of Cologne. However, the second criminal panel set aside the verdict, warning the lower court that, quote, recognizing a right to demonstrate to the extent accepted by the criminal chamber of the county court would be equivalent to legalizing terror committed by militant minorities, unquote. Baldus himself remarked during the proceedings, quote, the panel has no intention of creating a special legal status for university students, unquote. Since that time, the classic forms of nonviolent protest have counted as the use of force in West Germany. We're going to proceed now with the formal administration of this legal principle in German law. Now, again, notice the effect of the Lepley decision. This basically was to make legitimate, nonviolent protest illegal, and by making it the use of force, in quotes, that according to the legal definition that was established in this critical decision that was made by Judge Baldus, B-A-L-D-U-S, again, a Third Reich graduate, a Third Reich judicial graduate. What we're going to look at now is the formal institution in German law passed by the Bundestag, which basically reinstituted something consistent with the Lepley decision, and it reinstituted the criminalization of legitimate protest against the state and made it treasonous. This, again, by way of taking a look at the effect of the reconstitution of the Third Reich judiciary on a post-World War II Germany. In a chapter entitled, appropriately enough, "The Opposition Goes on Trial Again," Ingo Müller writes, "In its efforts to preserve, quote, valuable, unquote, statutes from the Third Reich, the Bundestag did not even balk at passing laws which had been revoked immediately after the war as, quote, typical of National Socialism," unquote. One of the Allies' very first denazification measures was abrogation of the lushly proliferating criminal statutes of 1934, designed to protect the regime and to suppress political opposition. The fundamental underlying aim of the architect of these laws, Minister of Justice Franz Gürtner, and his undersecretary Rodon Freisler, had been to, quote, shift the field of battle forward, unquote, that is, quote, to prosecute as treason, not only criminal or violent acts, but any action expressing opposition to the regime, even if the action as such did not violate the law. Now, again, I want to take another look at this, because this is a reinstitution of a critical Third Reich legal statute. One of the Allies' very first denazification measures was abrogation of the lushly proliferating criminal statutes of 1934, designed to protect the regime and to suppress political opposition. The fundamental underlying aim of the architects of these laws, Minister of Justice Franz Gürtner, G-U-umlaut R-T-N-E-R, and his undersecretary Rodon Freisler, had been to, quote, shift the field of battle forward, unquote, that is, quote, to prosecute as treason not only criminal or violent acts, but any action expressing opposition to the regime, even if the action as such did not violate the law. Less than 6 months after the Bundestag had been created, the elected government, now before I begin, I want to note that Franz Gürtner and Rodon Freisler were phrasing things thusly, in the passage quoted above, this for the institution of the Third Reich's legal code. Now again, Franz Gürtner and Rodon Freisler had ruled under the Third Reich that treason could be prosecuted, anything could be prosecuted as a criminal or violent act for treason, even if the action was not illegal. In other words, anything expressing opposition to the government. And we're going to see now the reinstitution of this very same legal procedure in the, quote, new, unquote, Germany. Continuing now with Hitler's Justice by Ingo Müller. Less than 6 months after the Bundestag had been created, the elected government presented a draft of a, quote, first law to amend the criminal code, unquote, which contained large sections of the National Socialist laws on political crimes, laws that had been abolished in 1945 and 6. The Federal Ministry of Justice presented a document in support of these measures in which, for simplicity's sake, it actually quoted Gürtner and Freisler. One more time, these last couple of sentences. Less than 6 months after the Bundestag had been created, the elected government presented a draft of a, quote, first law to amend the criminal code, unquote, which contained large sections of the National Socialist laws on political crimes, laws that had been abolished in 1945 and 6. The Federal Ministry of Justice presented a document in support of these measures in which, for simplicity's sake, it actually quoted Gürtner and Freisler. Quote, the modern state cannot rely for protection on the classic definitions of high treason. It requires new statutes that advance its line of defense, unquote. The echoes of Nazi legal thinking were no accident. The Bill on the Protection of the Republic had been written by none other than Dr. Josef Schafthöidle, now an official of the Federal Ministry of Justice, and as a former official of the Reich Ministry, a participant in the formulation of the political criminal statutes of the Third Reich. By the way, spellings, Gürtner, G-U-umlaut R-T-N-E-R, Freisler, F-R-E-I-S-L-E-R, did that before. And Josef Schafthöidle, S-C-H-A-F-T-H-E-U-T-L-E. Continuing. The aims of the government's bill became clear when it was debated on the floor of the Bundestag. Edvard Wahl, WHL of the Christian Democrats, reported for the legal committee that the, quote, new, unquote, regulations made it possible to prosecute acts, quote, which were, quote, more or less harmless in and of themselves. One more time. The aims of the government's bill became clear when it was debated on the floor of the Bundestag. Edvard Wahl of the Christian Democrats reported for the legal committee that the, quote, new, unquote, regulations made it possible to prosecute acts which were, quote, more or less harmless in and of themselves, unquote. It was the intention with which they were committed that made them criminal. Again, quoting, this intention reflecting hostility to the state is the technical legal means by which enemies of the state can be distinguished from the loyal opposition, unquote. When the objection was raised that this reinstated the Nazi statutes making a person's attitude a criminal offense, a speaker for the Federal Democratic Party replied, quote, yes, indeed. We are, in a certain sense, reintroducing a law that makes opinion a crime. However, we do not intend to punish the opinion, but only the act arising from this opinion. The act could, of course, be any of a multitude of acts not criminal as such. It was only the opinion behind them that made them into crimes. With this stroke, the Bundestag had, in the laconic words of Gustav Heinemann, then Minister of the Interior and later President of the Republic, quote, brought back to life, unquote, the definition of treason, quote, created by the Third Reich in 1934 when it altered the criminal norms of 1871, unquote. And this remains German law to this date. And again, note that, again quoting from Ingo Müller, when the objection was raised that this reinstated the Nazi statutes making a person's attitude a criminal offense, a speaker for the Federal Democratic Party replied, quote, yes, indeed. We are, in a certain sense, reintroducing a law that makes opinion a crime. However, we do not intend to punish the opinion, but only the act arising from this opinion. And this reinstituted a principal feature of the Third Reich's legal code. And we're going to jump ahead now to events that took place in 1985, just a few years ago. And what this basically does, the decisions that we're looking at here, basically refused. There was a motion before the Bundestag to overturn the, at least in a formal sense, the legal decisions made by the Third Reich's courts. This was rejected, as we shall see. And in a chapter that Ingo Müller entitles A Latter-Day Condemnation, unquote, of Nazi Justice, we read, the Control Commission's law, now this, by the way, the Allied Control Commission, and right after World War II, the Control Commission's Law No. 1 of September 20th, 1945, did rescind 25 laws, quote, of a political nature or establishing a state of emergency on which the Nazi regime was based, unquote, from the law to redress the danger to the people and the Reich, quote, enabling act, unquote, to the police regulation requiring foreigners performing forced labor in Germany to wear special identifying badges. Later, the Commission's Law No. 11... Oh, no, excuse me, this is the passage. This wrong note point here, beginning at the top. In spite of widely varying assessments of the nation's recent past, all the political parties represented in the Bundestag, the Christian Democrats, the Christian Social Union, the Free Democrats, the Social Democrats, and the Greens, in a rare demonstration of unanimity, passed a resolution on January 25, 1985, declaring, quote, that the institution known as, quote, the People's Court, unquote, was not a court in the true sense, but an instrument of terror used to impose National Socialist dictatorship, unquote. This gesture may have appeared to the general public as an uncompromising step toward closing a shameful chapter in German history, but on closer inspection it revealed itself as nothing more than an embarrassingly half-hearted measure. Press reports that the Bundestag had set aside the decisions of the People's Court were far from accurate. And again, the People's Court was a kangaroo court, a drumhead court set up by the Third Reich simply to basically railroad prison people into a prison or to the gallows. The West German legislature was still as unwilling to pass such a statute in 1985 as before. The formulation agreed upon was the far weaker phrase that, quote, in the judgment of the German Bundestag, the decisions of the People's Court have no legal validity. For this reason, unquote, the resolution continues, unquote, the decisions were set aside through legislation in the states in the first few years after the war, that is, before the Federal Republic was founded in 1949, and through regulations of the powers of occupation, either expressly in the form of statutes or in court proceedings initiated by petition. Vague as this document is, it still does not conform, it does not correspond to the facts. Skipping down in the text, after a very technical legal discussion of some very evasive language that was used by the Bundestag, Ingo Müller goes on to say, basically, of the laws vis-à-vis overturning the judgments of the people's courts in the Third Reich. In sum, the two laws left the assessment of whether sentences had been passed excessively severe... Beginning again, in sum, the two laws left the assessment of whether sentences had been excessively severe to courts consisting largely of the judges who had passed them in the first place and were thus particularly inclined to take the former political atmosphere into account. Even in cases where the laws prescribed automatic annulment of a conviction, public prosecutors had to confirm that it had been set aside and had to remove it from their records, this step frequently involving the victim in a long struggle, since prosecutors often simply refused to comply with the law. Skipping down, Federal Minister of Justice Engelhard, E-N-G-E-L-H-A-R-D, responded with a firm refusal to set aside any decisions of the People's Court or the Special Courts. Last sentence again. Federal Minister of Justice Engelhard responded with a firm refusal to set aside any decisions of the People's Court or the Special Courts. No argument was too silly to serve as an excuse. Among others, he mentioned that declaring all the decisions of the People's Court null and void would lead to the, quote, undesirable result, unquote, that even the rare acquittals would be voided. Engelhard appeared to assume that voiding an acquittal was equivalent to a conviction. He also argued that special court decisions should remain valid at least since, quote, most convictions involved ordinary cases of major crime, unquote. These, quote, arguments, unquote, clearly swayed the legal committee of the Bundestag. After only five meetings, the committee agreed to follow the minister's recommendations. It would not set aside a single judicial decision of the Nazi era. And this, again, in 1985, 7 years ago. Another thing that Ingo Müller points out in this book, and I'm not going to go into this, but that the professors of law in German universities were also, like prosecutors and judges and ministers of justice, graduates of the Third Reich's legal system, people who had faithfully served Hitler, so that the teaching of German law in German universities to future administrators or barristers basically was consistent with the Third Reich, and in a conformity to the Third Reich's legal code. This has had the effect of institutionally perpetuating legal decisions made during the Third Reich. Now, I realize that some of the legal language in the passing of some of these legislative actions vis-a-vis German law might seem a little bit abstruse to people. I've done my best to simplify it somewhat, but Ingo Müller, again, a former law professor and legal official, has basically delineated the significance of these rulings, and I've gone into this, again, because the laws of a country are the foundation of government, and quite obviously, to a frightening extent, the legal structure of the Third Reich, and even some of its principal legal statutes, such as making an opinion opposed to the state a crime, that, although they do not intend to punish the opinion, merely any act resulting from it, including lawful protest, the legal statutes of the Third Reich were perpetuated to an enormous extent, and the refusal, as late as 1985, to overturn any legal decisions of the Third Reich became official German law. Recall that in Radio Free America program number 2, we took a look at a 1981 decision in which the Reichstag fire verdict convicting Martinus von der Lubbe of setting the fire that burned down the Reichstag and which led to the suspension or the declaration of dictatorial laws by Hitler, that act and that decision, which resulted in von der Lubbe's execution, the Reichstag fire, a very well-known provocation committed by the Third Reich in order to obtain, in order to give Hitler dictatorial powers. That decision was made on the unchallengeable German law. It was given the power of unchallengeable German law in 1981. This after von der Lubbe's brother was attempting to clear his name. And this, again, by way of taking a look at the perpetuation of the legal structure and the legal code of the Third Reich, and this by way of taking a look at the nature of the state of which the Gehlen organization was an extension. That organization wielded a profound influence on American and world history. And next week, we're going to get into the structure and growth of the post-World War II German national security establishments, particularly the German General Staff, by way of taking a look at German national security policy and structure. And we're going to begin swinging back over to events on this side of the Atlantic. And this concludes this particular installment of Radio Free America number 37, How the United States Lost the Second World War.